This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is the great feminist writer and organizer, Selma James. She's the founder of the International Wages for Housework campaign. She was the co-author of a path-breaking feminist work called The Power of Women and the Subversion of the Community, which is included in a new collection of her works called Sex, Race, and Class, The Perspective of Winning, a selection of writings from, catch this, 1952 to 2011. Selma James, welcome to Progressive Radio.
I'm very happy to be with you.
You've been at this a while.
Yes.
Give us a little thumbnail autobiography.
Okay, I was born in Brooklyn, New York in 1930. You know, I'm not 25 if I wrote 50 years ago. And I was a working-class Jewish family, my father trying to get a branch of the Teamsters. He was a truck driver, and my mother had been a factory worker and was a housewife taking care of her three children. I married at 17 because that's the way that girls escaped then. Otherwise, they were pulled back by their dads. And I had a son within a year, and then that marriage collapsed. And by that time, I had been part of what was then called the Johnson Forest Tendency. That was a wing of the Trotskyist movement, which was led by C.L.R. James, and he wasn't so famous then, but he's better known now.
And how'd you get into that Trotskyist movement?
Well, my sister was part of it, and my other sister was part of a communist, and I had to choose between the two. And I liked the Trotskyists better. I was 15, and they seemed better to me, and so I joined their youth group, and I was shortly after that in a minority. And I've been in a minority ever since, technically speaking, but I always believe that the millions and I, we're together. I married CLR, who was deported during the McCarthy period because he was a West Indian.
And you were a victim of McCarthyism as well, I heard.
I was. I lost my job in the factory, and
how'd that come about?
Well, they just, you had to sign a loyalty form because it was doing something for the Navy. And so when I signed, and then they took my fingerprints and said that I was a member of a subversive organization, and there were charges against me, which I was in Los Angeles at the time, which if I went to Washington, D.C., they would be able to tell me what the charges were.
Oh, they didn't notify you what the charges were?
No, they wouldn't tell me unless I traveled 3,500 miles across the country.
But you were never arrested. You were just on a list.
I was never arrested. In fact, I was never charged. I was just sacked, fired, yes, from my job.
That's how the blacklist worked in the McCarthy period. Selma James, so tell me how you met C.L.R. James.
Well, he was the leader of this minority within Trotskyism, which I felt was where I wanted to be, because he was talking about the revolution and making the revolution in the United States, and I was there because that's what I wanted to do, so I definitely went with him. And in general, it seemed to me that I was learning how to think and how to put things together, and I was very comfortable as part of that organization. It also concentrated on getting grassroots people like me to speak and to write and to say what we thought. And ultimately, we put out a newspaper, and I wrote a column for it called A Woman's Place. I wrote about my neighbors and my life. That's where I started to write.
You told a fascinating story in this book, Sex, Race, and Class, about how he advised you to write your first pamphlet. You told him, I don't know how to write a pamphlet. And so how did he explain that?
Well, he said, oh, that's very simple. He said, all you need is a shoebox, and you make a slit on the top, and every time you have an idea, you put it on the piece of paper, and you put the paper in the box. And then one day, you open the box, you put all the pieces of paper together, and you'll have a pamphlet. I said, okay. I did what he said. And I did one day put my son in childcare, go to a friend's house at the same time I would have gone to work, and put all the pieces together, and by that evening I had a draft. It really worked, and I found out since then, thinking about it, that he learned that working with sharecroppers and trying to get them to do their own pamphlets and their own leaflets, and he became an organizer, I think, in part, down south.
And that's giving people their own voices.
Indeed, and you write something quite different if it's your life rather than somebody else's.
And what was he like? You were married for how long?
Well, we were together for almost 30 years. Yes, what was he like? Well, he made very good jokes.
That's important.
It is, and he always had observations, and always when you thought he didn't understand, he would come out with a sentence or two, making it clear he'd thought it all over. It was very annoying. He always knew more than you did. I really liked it, though.
I get the impression from this book, Selma James, that you think his later fame kind of obscures his larger contributions about organizing.
Well, I believe, I'm absolutely convinced that the reason he was so brilliant as a, quote, cultural guru, the reason his literary criticism, for example, is so good is because he was grounded in Marxism, and not merely, he didn't read it, he studied it. He made a reevaluation of it. He read Hegel because Marx read Hegel. He read Hegel because Lenin read Hegel, so that he really got into it. And what he found out fundamentally was that we as human beings are capable of great change by our own activity in a collective way, and that the kind of organization for those of us who want to change the world has to be based on that ability to change, based on the creativity and the self-activity of those of us, especially at the grassroots, but in the whole of, in every level of society. And I think it's an absolutely crucial point of view, which I think Occupy can learn from. We in the Wages for Housework campaign internationally have learned from that. It changes because the grassroots changes. Of course, it's not, as he put it forward, 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, but he laid the basis for conceiving of how you relate to the public and how great the public can be, even when at any particular moment we're not.
Yeah, I'm speaking with Selma James. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. That approach, that orientation is the opposite of an elitist approach, the opposite of a vanguardist Leninist approach.
It is indeed.
It's an approach that has faith in people.
And what else can you base yourself on? I mean, the only alternative to basing yourself on what you say, what you call the people, what I always say is the grassroots, is to base yourself on the elite, that they're going to be able to tell us how. They can't find their way out of a paper bag. They've been incompetent or reactionary. And those who have done well have been watching us and taking leadership from the movement, from the struggle, not from this individual or that, but from what we do together collectively, both what is on the surface and what is below the surface that's happening day to day that people don't know about.
And this day-to-day orientation of yours, Selma James, has been so path-breaking. You have emphasized and focused on your entire political life and your writing life here in feminism on the day-to-day ordinary lives of women and what they're dealing with and how they're dealing with injustice and how they can rectify that injustice.
Well, that's absolutely the case. First of all, we have to begin with the actual lives people live. You know, unless we're very religious and think we're going to have a life later, we better pay attention to this one. And for women, first of all, our work is survival. And survival not only for ourselves, but for our families, for our children, for our cousins, for our uncles, for our aunties, for the whole community. Women are all over the world, are the carers, the ones who see that people can survive in Haiti against the storm and against dictatorships, and in the United States in the unemployment that we are seeing now, and the poverty, the almost half the people in the country, in the richest country in the world, are poor. Is this the richest country then? Then you have to ask yourself. And women doing this work are not even seen to be working. And a woman, a welfare mother, 2 days ago here in Wisconsin, said what I thought was most profound, that the government now considers that you are a good mother if you leave your children behind and get a job. Well, excuse me, the reproduction of the human race is rather important, and we won't let them forget that, and we won't let them tell us and force us into the position where we are defending the market against survival, which is what they are proposing right now.
And that's what all of welfare reform was like since the day of Bill Clinton. You know, you should have a baby and then 6 weeks later send that baby to daycare and get into the workforce.
That's right. And we know now that it has psychological and physical consequences. You know, love is not merely a healer. Love is really what makes the biology work. And these children are being deprived of that by government diktat. And I think we women don't want only to be carers. That's absolutely the case. But we don't want to give up caring. We want some help with this caring. And we want men to be carers as well. We think it's very good to be a carer. It's very good to put other human beings' interests before your own. That's what you do as a carer. And that would do wonders for most men. It was much better than the jobs they're doing now or the jobs they're trying to get that aren't even there. So we think that reproducing the human race is not only crucial, not only central, but also offers great possibilities for a caring society for the first time in a very long time.
Selma James, you write and argue that attacks on welfare and the welfare state are an attack on women's independence. Do you want to explain that?
Well, you know, those of us who have been in the women's movement for 20 or 30 years know very well that it was single mothers who did a lot of the movement work, who started all of the services for women, all kinds of services of health, etc., who were campaigners at Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp, which we have in the UK, was lesbian women and single mothers, often both the same person. And that was because we had a little income and we didn't have a man who was disciplining us. We were financially independent. We related either to men or to women, but we related against war, and we organized in all kinds of ways. Nowadays, it's really difficult to get volunteers at our women's center because everybody has to have a job or has to be looking for a job or has to be preparing herself for a job. And there are all kinds of services which are no longer available, which we can't answer the call for, and we just have no time. We have no time for ourselves. We have no time for our children. We have no time for our movement. And welfare has been the underpinning of movements for justice. It's given us a chance to organize. Welfare mothers were very powerful in the 60s in this country. Half or more than half of welfare mothers were women in the countryside, white women in the countryside, farm workers, but it was black women in the cities, largely, not only, who organized for welfare to rise. And as welfare rose, so did the minimum wage. It is the floor under wages. And when you cut welfare, you give every wage earner, you know, you give them, you undermine them. You make it more difficult for them to maintain their wage level and to increase it. And that's women, first of all, and then, of course, men.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Selma James. You're listening to Progressive Radio. This is the coercion of the marketplace that makes people work when they'd rather be home with their kids, makes people work just here in the United States because they need the health insurance. They'd rather be home.
That's right.
And also, I hadn't thought about this, that the coercion of the marketplace reduces your time to engage in social justice work. That may be another reason why you've been a proponent not only just of welfare, but of what we used to call a social wage or a guaranteed income.
That's right, I am. But my problem with the guaranteed income, I think we deserve the money, there's no question. What it hides is that work, that what we are doing is work. You know, we have had a lot of problem for the society to acknowledge, and the GNP or GDP does not acknowledge, the basic government figures does not acknowledge, that when you are caring for people whom you care about, that's work. You know, if you get a job and it's lower paid and it's hardly the minimum wage, oh, yes, you're working. But if you do the same thing with more care, more attention, more hours for people you absolutely are committed to, they say, oh, well, you're just home.
Now, this is Selma James I'm speaking with. This insight that she's just articulated, she has done more than probably anyone in the world to draw attention to what she termed unwaged work, not paying women for the work that they're doing at home as a housewife or as a mother or as a care provider for an elderly parent, which a lot of women are doing these days.
Indeed.
This is an incredible line that you wrote. The woman is the slave of a wage slave, and her slavery ensures the slavery of the man.
Well, that is a snapshot of how the world really is. And we're very concerned to make clear that the housewives are not only populating the UK and the US. Housewives are all over the world. And, you know, I like the figure very much that African women grow 80% of the food that is consumed in Africa. That is also unwaged and not counted. You know, this, again, you know, the only thing that you can do with that food is save lives. Well, it can't be that important then. You know, who's making a profit on that? Nobody. This woman is going out at 4 or 5 in the morning and comes back at 4 or 5 in the evening and then has to cook food and all the rest. And she's not really working because, well, all that happens is that her children and her family and her community survive. And we want to change the priorities. If that's what she's doing, if survival is the result of her work, then what work could possibly be more important than that? We need an international women's movement because internationally our work is demeaned and not counted, and our children are demeaned too. Their lives don't matter. Somebody told me that 20,000 children are sleeping in shelters in New York every night. And that is a heartbreaking figure. Just think in terms of the cost of one fighter jet and think of these children. What is it we want? And women in particular, not only women are anti-war, please, I know the men are also, but women from our position as carers have always spearheaded the anti-war movement because our responsibility has been care for the human race. We don't want to do it alone, but while we're doing it, we learned a few things.
Speaking with Selma James, I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. It's a thrill for me to have Selma James here, to have you right here on radio with me, because you've been such a champion, early champion, and a theorizer on this question of unwaged work and the injustice of it. You say we need an international women's movement. There is an international women's movement. You founded in 1972 the International Wages for Housework campaign. How is that going? And then how do you assess the international women's movement right now?
Well, first of all, that international network that we built has been crucial to everything we've done. You know, we check with the Guyana women and the women in India and the domestic workers in Peru, we in London, as well as in industrial countries, because we want to know what they are experiencing and how the problems relate to them. And in fact, when we issued the petition in the United States for Welfare, which is available online, and we are doing the same thing in the UK, we are also doing it in Guyana because we feel that the women in third world countries are not benefiting enough from when those of us in industrial countries make a campaign and even win it. And we want the money that comes in aid often as corruption and often as strengthening the military in third world countries. We want that money to go first and foremost to mothers. That's what we in industrial countries are going to be saying in conjunction with women in third world countries. Now, in the year 2000, the Wages for Housework campaign gave birth to the Global Women's Strike because we wanted to be a more obviously active network working and organizing and campaigning in a number of countries. And it's the strike now which is issuing this petition. And the campaign, the Wages for Housework campaign, informs it. But the strike is the organizer, and the strike is building the international network.
You know, it's interesting because one of the goals of the Global Women's Strike, as you're alluding to, as I understand it anyway, is to not spend so much money on the military, spend it on social needs.
Absolutely.
And the United States, on the other hand, when it's dealing with other countries, including NATO countries, is trying to coerce governments in NATO to spend more on their military.
Yes.
And by force, then less on social programs.
Well, you know, that's the fight. That is, in fact, what we always called the class struggle. We are struggling. Either the money is for us and for the reproduction of the human race, or it's for the military and the market. And we have to fight it out. And we, as a women's movement, as a women's network, we have the support of men. We have a men's organization that relates to us. And by the way, they have worked primarily on soldiers and others refusing the military. And their slogan is, refusing to kill is not a crime. Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, when the market is in charge, it's absolutely criminal to try to save your own life and to save the lives of your community. So we feel that we're spearheading a corner of the movement which is really strengthening all those who are against unwaged work, against work being unwaged, and who are in favor of prisoners, for example, and the kind of movement that prisoners have formed. All kinds of sectors have made their own independent case against the market, and we've tried to reflect that in the organizations within the strike. There's an autonomous organization of sex workers, for example, you know, who always tell us, you know, we've seen the money. They say doesn't exist. They say it doesn't exist. I've seen that guy, and he took out a roll. And they, every time there is a cut in welfare, there are more women working in the street. That they know this. And, you know, sometimes I wonder if their austerity is just a bit tainted with their sexual desires. Anyway, we'll leave that for now.
But let's talk a little more about austerity because, I mean, Global Women's Strike, your motto is invest in caring, not killing. There's not a lot of caring going on with these austerity packages that are being forced upon people throughout Europe right now. How do you counteract that?
Well, you know, the first thing is they expect women to pick up the pieces. When they cut services, they expect us to work harder. And either we will pick up the pieces or we won't. And for them, it doesn't matter either way. If we pick up the pieces, our children survive. If we don't, they don't survive. And it really is not a consideration of the government, as I see it, in the UK, certainly, and also obviously in the US, and in the whole of Western Europe. You see that Greece is exploding and Spain is not far behind. And they really want to get us back to where we were before the welfare states were formed. And, you know, I can't tell Americans, I can't describe to Americans what it means to have a national health service when you really don't have to worry about your medical bills and when you're sure that anyone you know is going to have access to medicine and to whatever medicine is needed without a worry, without that kind of debt, which makes you ill in the first place. And you don't have to choose your job in relation to which one will give you medical care or the best medical care, because you're going to have that. And you can say, well, I don't want this job because, you know, the hours are too long or the conditions are too bad. And you don't say, I have to take it because my kid needs a doctor.
I mean, that's how primitive our healthcare system is in the United States. It's going to get a little better with the Affordable Care Act. I think you're absolutely right that there's this total campaign against the welfare state, against any notion of a civilized capitalism, against not only FDR, but the progressive era. They want a party like it's 1898 is what I like to say. So
yes.
They really want to roll the clock back. Fortunately, they didn't succeed here in this election that we had on November 6th, and Obama won. But I worry that he is still going to cave into some austerity demands. What do you think?
Well, I don't start with Obama now. I started with Obama that he had to win the election because he had to get rid of that Romney person. But we base ourselves on now, it seems to me, on what Obama owes us. We got him elected. Black people voted for Obama more this time than last time. It's not because they didn't know what he had not done and what he shouldn't have done and did, but because they knew that some worse was to come, and they were not going to allow them the forces of darkness to kick out a black man from the presidency. Women voted for Obama in larger proportion than men. Latinos voted for Obama. Asians voted for Obama. He has a debt to all of us now, and I've been speaking to people here in the last week, and everybody agrees that we have to collectively make our demands and not wait for institutions to do it for us, because they'll either screw up the demand or not make it at all. We have to do it ourselves, and we have to make our case to him, and we have to demand that he pay us for having elected him. Now, whether he'll do that or not, I don't know. I don't know. But we can change the political climate in that way, and we can make it clear to the military, who seems to be in charge of poor Mr. Obama, in spite of his great talent and skill, he, you know, that thing is bigger than both of them. And we have to ask Michelle, maybe we can get a little something from her. You know, she seems to me more sensible than he is, and is a carer as well. And I just feel that this is the moment in time when we have to come together. And I think it's really, really important that we know that our ability to come together in a solid way is dependent on our recognizing the differences among us, the disparities of power among us. Those of us who are black are not in the same position as those of us who are white or who are Latina or who are older or who have disabilities or who have a criminal record or who are in prison. We acknowledge these differences, and coming together, we seek to undermine them, but we address them. And I think we have a good chance at this moment in time in this country, and of course other people would be affected, to get it together and to make our demands happen.
Well, let's get it together. Selma James, thanks so much for my guest today on Progressive Radio. It's been a tremendous honor speaking with you.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.